amazing experiment in racial integration. The community was 50% African American, 50% white. It was during the labor strife of the late 1800s in the Hocking Valley coal region. Colonel William P. Rand, a Civil War general, invested in the Ohio Central Railroad, which is this railroad that still goes down the Sunday Creek Valley. Three rival railroads that were all coming after the Civil War to get to this mother load of coal known as the Straitsville vein of coal in the Hocking Valley. Ohio Central Railroad, that really created this town, got delayed in 1873 because of the big hillside that creates, I guess, is the watershed changer here, but north at the town of Moxahela, and they went bankrupt building the tunnel through the hill to build the railroad. So the railroad stopped in 1873 and didn't resume until 1880, when a guy by the name of Erastus Corning put up the money to get things going again. When they got through the hillside just north of here and into the Sunday Creek Valley, the first mining town they created was Renville, and then Corning, and then on down the valley to into Athens County. Rand was different than most of the coal operators. He believed in not only recruiting folks from Central and Eastern Europe and African Americans out of the South to work in his mines, but different than a lot of the operators, he believed in paying them equally, and he was one of the more fair operators in the area. He instituted changes at his mines here that became standards in the industry and part of the labor movement. They let workers weigh the coal so it would be fairly weighed, because the mines were known for cheating with their scales on what people got paid for digging coal. They also had screens that they would run the coal over and all the little pieces would fall through. Well, some mines had bigger holes in their screens than others, and Rand worked to get everyone to have unified screens so that everyone was paid fairly. So he was a man of fairness. His mines were off and on racially integrated from 1880 to about the year 1900 was pretty remarkable. And the big stories we tell, and we have a marker up here by the town hall that tells about these stories, are that some amazing gentlemen arrived here to work in the coal operation. And one was Adam Clayton Powell Sr., famous people in the 1900s. Adam came here as a young miner in the 1880s, and this church was having a revival. And in his autobiography, he talks about being a womanizer, gambler, drunk, and near murderer. And he got pulled in by the spirit of the revival into this church and changed his ways and went on to Union Theological Seminary in New York and became the pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church, which at the time was the largest Protestant congregation in the nation that served Harlem, New York. And he became kind of the spiritual leader of the Harlem Renaissance. He was the founder of the National Urban League, one of the co-founders of the NAACP, a well-respected man in terms of early civil rights movements in this community. His son, Adam Clayton Powell Jr., was elected to Congress in the 1950s and 60s and was expelled from Congress for some shady deals he made and bribes he took, I think. Got pictures of him on the cover of Time magazine. When I was a young kid in the 1960s, I remember Adam Clayton Powell being a very controversial figure. But Adam Sr. got his start in this church. The main street down Harlem, New York, is Adam Clayton Powell Way. Another gentleman that came here was Dr. Isaiah Tuppins. Rand hired him as his mine doctor. Tuppins had just finished his degree at the Columbus Medical College, and that made him the first African American in the state of Ohio to ever become a medical doctor. So he came here, was not only the medical doctor, but he was elected mayor of the community in 1888, I believe. And that made him the first African-American mayor elected in the northern United States, and only the second African-American mayor elected anywhere in the United States. He wrote lots of letters to the African-American newspapers in Cleveland and Columbus, and so we have a lot of his writings. He was very active in the Republican Party, of the favored party among people of color because of Lincoln's work and the Emancipation Proclamation. He also served on the executive committee of the Republican Party in this county and in the state, so he was quite an active figure. And the third guy from this period that's pretty amazing is Richard L. Davis, who also came here from the South, African-American man, and he got caught up in the fervor of the labor union movement here, the Knights of Labor, and then he went on and he was one of two people of color who were at the founding convention of the United Mine Workers of America in Columbus in 1890, and he rose to the executive committee of the UMW in 1896, which was a major breaking of the color barrier too. So there are a lot of pretty phenomenal stories here. There was some racial tension and discrimination, but for the most part, people got along here pretty darn well and lived alongside of one another. In my opinion, and this isn't backed up by any certified historians or anything, this town stayed racially integrated until the 1920s when the Ku Klux Klan got organized in the nation. That was their most fervent decade, was the 1920s. It was right after the First World War, and there was a lot of anger toward German Americans as well as black. I know my family left here and moved to Corning and tried to fit into a more white community. And if you look at the census records, you see a out-migration of a lot of the white families out of Renville. So from about the 1930s to the 60s, this town was predominantly a black community. Most people around here have no idea that white people lived here in the early days. People just have always associated it with people of color. It was really the only place in this county that people of color lived. The local high school basketball team in Corning was always known for having African-American players on their team and really putting up with some crazy stuff when they traveled to some of the communities in the northern part of the county that were more closed-minded farm communities. And I remember as a kid, Jesse Roberts was my little league baseball coach, and he was from Renville, a black man that I can remember being at the Bookville playground and kids throwing rocks at our coach during a ball game. So rural African-American life in this part of the world is a pretty interesting piece of history. What about now? This community is Ohio's smallest incorporated village with about 38 people, and they still have a mayor and council here struggling to keep the town moving and alive. Their biggest job is to keep the wine forest from totally eating the town because there are a lot of vacant lots here have to be mowed, so they spend a lot of money on mowing. There's really two other neighborhoods in town that the highway straightening project took away, so there's a whole neighborhood up on top of the hill and the cemetery's up there, and then there's another neighborhood here. You know, I have the history here, but the Great Hocking Valley Coal Strike of 1884-85 brought national attention to this area. The Syndicate was an organization that was formed by the mine owners in the Hocking Valley to all get together as one group and set the price of coal for the year. And once they formed in 1884, they dropped the price paid to the miners from 70 cents to 50 cents a ton, which set off this strike. And the miners here up to that point had tried to resist labor unions that believed in strikes and taking action against the owners. Up to that point, they were in the Knights of Labor, who thought that you could talk things out, and they were very ceremonial type of organization that was trying to bring the brotherhood of men together. They had very high ideals. But by 1884, the miners here had had enough, and they started the Hocking Valley Coal Strike, which resulted in a nine-month strike that resulted in people losing their company homes and having to live in tents, people facing near-starvation conditions for food. And ironically enough, during that strike, William P. Rand kept his mines open, continued to pay 70 cents a ton, and gave his miners the option of taking 10 cents of their pay and putting it into a fund to send to help with the emergency food operations. He wasn't perfect, much more pro-labor, and even more important was what we call the joint conference system of labor negotiations. So after the strike ended in 1885 and the miners didn't win the wage part of it, but they won a lot of victories with the Ohio legislature that implemented laws that outruled forcing people to shop at the company store and a number of other things. Rand and the major labor leader from this area, Christopher Evans from New Straitsville, got together and called for a joint meeting of the owners and the union representatives in the coal fields. And during that period of time, you think of West Virginia and Kentucky being the coal-producing states in this part of the world. The nation's coal fields were centered in western Pennsylvania, southeastern Ohio, southern Illinois, southern Indiana. That was the bituminous coal field in this country. So they had their first meeting in Chicago, and Rand was the only mine owner that showed up, and a lot of of Union people went to Chicago and were defeated in that cause. The fall after the strike, they had another meeting in the fall in Pittsburgh, and they got three or four mine owners to come, but still not enough to come to any sort of agreement. And then the following year in Columbus, they had enough mine owners there, and they came to what was what's known as the first ever jointly negotiated interstate labor contract in the United States, where the price of coal was set for the coal-producing states in the nation. And so Rand, the owner, and Chris Evans, the union leader from New Straitsville, right here out of the little cities of Black Diamonds, Hocking Valley region, really made history. Richard L. Davis was self-educated, but he wrote letters to every week to the United Mine Workers Journal and to the National Labor Journal. And so we have this wonderful record of his opinions, which were seen as quite radical in the day, of integrating the workers of this country and really making the case that all workers were slaves. I mean, it was pretty radical labor stuff. And he eventually, because he was seen as such a rabble-rouser, couldn't get work here. Rand, that's one of the scars on Rand's perfect story, is that he quit employing Davis because he saw him as too much of a rabble-rouser. One of the other significant historic events was that in 1885, he was on the state committee for the United Mine Workers, and the national officers were coming to the hotel in Corning for the District 6 meeting of the United Mine Workers, which included West Virginia and Ohio. So when they got there, the West Virginia miners were offended by having to sit at the same table in the same room with black miners, complained to the hotel owner, and the hotel owner asked Richard L. Davis to leave. Instead, the entire Ohio delegation and the national officers walked out, and the hotel in Corning was fined, first fine ever in state history for disobeying the anti-discrimination, which required that all establishments in Ohio serve people of color. So he won that battle, the hotel was fined, and then he filed a civil suit in Perry County Court, and his local peers in Perry County decided he wasn't to be awarded any damages for the wrong. But another little piece of Ohio history. What we've noticed here, and this is the story of the Sunday Creek and Monday Creek valleys, is that these towns were made up of immigrants, folks without a lot of political power. They were seen as just as immigrants are seen today, coming in and taking away jobs and fouling the civil life of the proper communities. Towns like Athens and New Lexington and Logan and McConnellsville, they were making a lot of money off the coal mines. Wealth was growing as communities, but they really resented the people who were the workers here. What we've noticed as we started to try to understand our story here over the past 20 or so years is that our story's never been told from our perspective. It's always told from outside perspectives. And so we've had to go other places to find out what went on here, and then we've been trying to piece this story together from our perspective. It's a place of rich history, recovering natural environments, the state's only national forest, trying to find a more positive future for ourselves than being just seen as a place with polluted streams and poor people and decaying communities. Been involved with the group called Sunday Creek Associates that's started the Little Cities of Black Diamonds Council and a number of other initiatives in this area to bring this story to life. And over the years, we've became very close partners with folks like Monday Creek and Sunday Creek and Rural Action, reviving this part of the world that we think is pretty darn special.
Not really, but I like interesting things.
Okay. Oh my God, John, I forgot. Was it 12 years ago? Render Arts was founded. We are a day cab for individuals with developmental disabilities. We service Southeast Ohio. We have people from Newland, Somerset Junction, Perry County. A couple morning time people that come up sometimes. What we do is, in the mornings, I'm a soccer mom, I pick everybody up in the van, and we come here and we help them to create basically just a express themselves through different mediums, create art. You're going to see a lot of different things here. We have paint, woodworking, oil, acrylic, watercolor, sculptures, things like that. And everything is for sale. And 90% of the sale goes to the artist. We keep 10 for supplies and whatnot. We have two major shows a year. We have one here that's our spring open house, and we have one in the fall. Does anybody know the Brindu Mansion in Newark? Okay, it's a big plantation style mansion, and we have a fall show there, and it's friggin' awesome, isn't it? It's a really big mansion. It's our biggest show. It brings in $2,500 grand through the sales. Our record, we had an artist make $500. We are owned through the Such Car Company. They're a service provider, and they're based out of Athens County, but we have a branch in ULEX that we work out of. We were a part of another agency as a nonprofit. We are switched to for-profit now. Becky likes to do pretty ladies. Tori and Eric fashion. She's very into the very feminine stuff. You're going to be able to tell, once you come down, you can look and tell what artists their stuff. They have a style, just like any other artist. They have a unique signature, a unique style. And that's what we get here, is they, it's usually not creating something, you know, completely original, but their own take on it. And that's awesome. Our artist did this it's called Bug Splatter with the yellow and white. He's actually legally blind to death. So he shapes, he sees colors, he can feel patterns, and this is kind of what he makes up. So we have a very wide range of music. Yes! We have t-shirts for sale that
it's
was
duct tape.
We had it for our design in front of it. He's a Broadway fan, so we have the Lion King as our logo this year on our shirt. He actually goes to Broadway with his family and watches all the musicals on there, so.
This building.
There's a restroom there if you want to stop.
To help
make some clay things for several years.
And Jerry and a group of people just formed the Renville Historic Preservation Society, and the group is going to try to, we have a person who's willing to donate this house to us to make a small museum to tell the story that I've been telling you today. And the folks at the Renville Artwork are probably going to be the daily host out of it. And his students over the last few years have saved the house and boarded it up and painted the windows. Here could be a nice stop along Route 13 to learn about history, see some art, and be a destination for visitors. So,
steps.
110 steps go up to the Renville school site. A racially integrated school operated here from the 1880s until 1960.
Up there?
Up on the hill, yeah. And actually, if you walk up those steps, or you can drive around, go down to the next road and drive up there. It's pretty interesting. Some of the walls are still standing. You can see chalkboards up on a couple of the walls. It's kind of an interesting. You'd probably be trespassing, but it's an out-of-town owner from Cleveland or something that's probably hadn't been here in 20 years or something that owns the actual property. So, yeah.
Get that out.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
This part of the project was completed in 2010 and 11. There are two phases. First phase was straight reclamation. How many of you are familiar with acid mine drainage and abandoned coal mine landscapes? This region was heavily mined late 1800s to early 1900s as far as underground mines. Subsequently, a lot of the areas that were deep mined were then gone, and we went back to those, and they were actually strip mined as well by companies in the 1940s through 70s in this particular region. So some of these areas have been mined twice over. That brought a lot of really unnatural landscapes. Anything that was mined before 1977 is not regulated by any sort of reclamation law. So there wasn't an overarching state or national law that required coal operators to reclaim land after they mined it. As soon as you got as much coal out as you wanted, you could be on your way to the next spot. You didn't have to do anything to the land. Well, in 1972, Ohio passed a law that required some reclamation on coal sites. In 1977, the Surface Mine Reclamation and Control Act, or SMCRA as it's often called, passed at the national level. That's the law that the coal operators are still governed by today. That SMCRA law also created the Office of Surface Mining and the mechanism for having coal operators pay severance tax on every ton of coal that's mined today. And that money goes into a fund that's then distributed to states that had coal mining before 1977 so that abandoned coal mining sites can be reclaimed. So a lot of the funding that we use for our work in Sunday Creek and in Monday Creek, reclaiming these abandoned coal mine sites, that's where a lot of that funding comes, that money that's being collected from current coal operators and put into a trust fund that's then distributed. We do have an active coal mine in Sunday Creek in the watershed. You drove past it, I'm not sure if you noticed the signs for Buckingham. Between Gloucester and Corning, there's an active coal mine. They're mining two different underground mines, the 6th and the 7th seam of coal, but they are regulated by EPA for any water that they discharge off of their site. So we're not dealing with issues that's coming from active coal mining. We're only focusing on areas that have had these abandoned coal mine issues. There's a photo under the West Branch Headwaters. When we walked up and you guys were looking out this field, that's the view of this. So the creek is right there. And this photo was taken as if we were standing right here looking back that way. So it's all black. It's all gob. That's refuse coal that was left behind after this mine closed. At this particular spot, there was two separate mines. There was a mine on this side of the road, and there was a mine on that side of the road. Because of that, it's two very separate discharges that are very different in chemistry. We had to do two different projects. When we're talking about treating acid mine drainage, we're talking about treating water that is heavy in metals, generally iron and aluminum, sometimes manganese, in our part of the world. In Southeast Ohio, generally our mine discharges are very acidic. So we're talking, at this particular site, the water that's coming out of that pipe into this bed is an average of 4 for the pH. So we want water to be at a 7. For stream life, generally it needs to be between 6 and 8 is kind of the sweet spot for organisms, fish and bugs, to really be able to thrive. 4 is almost getting to the point where really nothing can live. The way that acid mine drainage is formed happens underground. So imagine you've got an underground coal mine. Coal's been layered as it has been for millions of years. You go in, tunnel down, you pull that coal out. What do you leave?
Pillars.
Okay, so you leave pillars to hold up the roof. But what's where the coal was?
A hole.
A void, right? There's nothing there because we took it out. So we've opened up all of this area underground that's never been opened before, that's never had access to water, to oxygen. It's been building up for millions of years. So once we have that water and oxygen getting down into these areas, it starts reacting with pyrite, which is found in our coal seams or right next to our coal seams. And that reaction creates the acidity and the metals. The metals leach out of those minerals that are now exposed. We have continuous reactions happening. So as long as there's water and oxygen in the mine, until all of that pyrite has reacted out, we'll continue to have acid mine drainage coming out of that mine. In some cases, there's mines that are over in Europe, where the Roman Empire era mines, it's been thousands of years, and they say that there's still mine drainage coming out that's polluted. Depending on the area of the mine and the amount of that pyrite that's exposed, we could be looking at hundreds of years yet of acid mine drainage that we'll need to treat. We want to continue to recover our streams.
Some of the mines estimating like a million years.
It's incredibly overwhelming. It's daunting when you think about it, because the work that we're doing, while we're seeing incredible recovery in Sunday and Monday Creek and in the streams that we're working in, it's not something that you can just do and then like pat yourself on the back and just go home and sit. You know, you can't just leave it. Even systems like this one, which we call a passive system, which generally doesn't need as much maintenance, addition of more material or that kind of thing, we still have to watch the system. We still have to maintain the system. This system won't last forever. This system will probably last maybe 15 years. And then if we want to continue treating at this spot, we'll have to rehab this particular bed with new stone, or try to wash this stone, or come up with a different treatment system. The active treatment that we do, we have a limestone doser just down the road. It's called an active treatment because we're continually adding material to it. So it's not something that can just set and work on its own. That addition of an alkaline material helps neutralize the acid and allows metals to drop out of the water and then be contained in a smaller area of the stream, so that downstream we have a lot more recovery. But those systems take even more work. We're not fixing the problem completely, we're treating it. When we write grants for these systems, we actually, you know, say we're going to treat in perpetuity, which really just means until DNR runs out of money to support treatment projects. One thing that you can do and leave is just straight reclamation. So the picture I showed you of all that gob, that refuse old coal material, that's what this whole area looked like.
It was like that clear to the tree line, right?
It was. It was really incredible. And this site looks totally different.
Big piles where we're standing.
Yeah, huge piles of that material. And then this hollow back this way was a huge beaver pond that had a pH of like 3. So it was really acidic water just sitting up here in this valley. Big piles of black gob. Nothing's growing on it. Not even grass will grow on it. So what we did that will last and is more of a permanent fix is just straight reclamation. That material was regraded so that it wasn't big piles of stuff. We created this kind of rolling hill, meadowy kind of area that is what we have now. We capped it with clay. We use clay so that water doesn't penetrate through it. So clay is pretty impermeable. So we use that as a cap over that material. Because the same way that the acid mine drainage is formed underground as water and oxygen react with that material, the same thing can happen on the surface. So with that, all that gob sitting there, every time it rained, that water was leaching through, picking up acidity, picking up metals from the surface, and then going right into the creek right here. So we had a really diffuse, so by covering up all of that material, capping it with clay so that water wouldn't get down to it, and then seeding it with the prairie grasses, we're really able to encourage positive drainage so that the drainage, the water comes quickly off the site, doesn't ever drain down into the gob, goes quickly into the creek as clean rainwater. So that also decreases the amount of acidity and metals that we have in the creek. So we did that part of the project first. That was in 2010. The next year in 2011, we started construction here at this site on the limestone leach bed. This bed includes 1,278 tons of limestone. It's a lot of limestone. And it's about 3 feet deep. So this bed is what we call a successfully failing system. If this system fails, if it fills up, then we succeeded because that's exactly what we want it to do. As water comes in, it's a pH of 4. It has a lot of aluminum and iron at this site, but it's all dissolved in the water at that low pH. So when it comes in, because it's stuck in this bed, we have time to settle out those materials. And because it's limestone, it's a real alkaline material, so it's reacting with the acidity that's in the water. It's neutralizing that acidity and it's allowing those metals, the pH goes up, the closer we get to 7, the quicker those metals fall out. So iron and aluminum are actually getting trapped in this system. The limestone will eventually, as iron and aluminum start covering that. So in the first bottom layer, 3 feet down from where we're standing, the rocks are probably almost covered after 4 years. A lot of the reactive quality of these rocks are probably spent. Because once they get covered with iron, there's no more surface area for the limestone to react. So then we have, because this bed was built in 3 layers, I have an agar drain over here, which is just, it's a dam system where I can push blocks down to raise the water level in this bed. So right now, after 4 years, we're still unexpectedly using the first layer of limestone. We haven't had to put any of those stop blocks down. We expected that this bed may only last 10 years. So we really expected to have to do it after 2.5, 3 years, and put at least one down to raise the level up. But we're seeing really good treatment out of this bed. The pH comes in at about 4 with high levels of concentration for iron. This site actually has a fair bit of aluminum, which can be really toxic to fish and bugs. So we really wanted to make sure we captured all of that before it went into the creek. So this particular one, this is showing the pH. So we have down here, it's 3.5, it goes all the way up to 7.29. Our goal is 7 for pH. This is before the first green line, that was construction for phase 1. So that was just the reclamation and covering up that gob, closing a couple big subsidence holes that were capturing rainwater and funneling it down into the mines. So we see a little bit of a bump in pH after that first construction, but then the second line of construction is when we did phase 2, so when we actually built this limestone bed and started passively treating the AMD. And you can see what a large bump that is. First, under construction, we were getting like 6, somewhere in the 6s. But now we're, for the last couple years, we've consistently gotten right around 7 or above 7. We thought that the first level would be failing by now, so we are still monitoring this treatment site quarterly so that we can catch when it does start filling a little bit and we can get that next block down and not lose any of the gains that we've made in recovery. The untreated water is still, every time we're out here measuring it, it's somewhere between 3 and 4.5. So still really low pH, but we're getting almost 7 at the outlet. From 50 to 160 milligrams per liter of alkalinity is being added to the stream every day. So.
The ups and downs, is that when the water runs a whole lot faster, you get more water through and you're not treating it as fast?
Yeah, since we're measuring quarterly, we're often getting really different flow regimes. So we may be at really low flow and really high flow the next time. So we notice that when we're out here after a big rain, the pH that comes in is much higher because we are getting some rainwater that's going through the system. We want this system to fail eventually. We want it to trap the iron and the aluminum in it. We want it to be here and not in the stream. So instead of building, adding alkalinity and then building a separate settling pond to try to get that iron to come out, we just decided to try to trap it here in the bed itself. And this data goes all the way back to 2001, so most of the iron is being trapped in the bed that's at the site. Same for aluminum. Before we did this project, you could actually see, because this creek down there, when we get down there, it's very orange, but out of that pipe, you could actually see a little white river running right through the middle of the creek, and that's where the aluminum was showing up. The orange color in our creeks is from the iron concentrations, and the white or a silvery blue color is often indicative of aluminum. If the bed ever got plugged, we could use those to clean them out, pump water through there, and push out whatever was clogging.
Does this have a manifold system of piping throughout the entire bed that leads to those?
It does. We didn't anticipate this bed lasting as long as it's probably going to last. So we were thinking it was going to fill up and that was the point, and then we would have to deal with it.
Why are some stones red and some are gray?
The stone that we got, some of them actually do have some iron in them. They're not probably as reactive as the gray ones, but that was the stone that we were able to get.
It's all limestone though, correct?
It is all limestone, yes.
Smaller stone is treating better. We've run into the same thing. We're going on 3 years and we've not had to put a stock block down to raise the level to fresh lime. Still treating really well. Well, the one with the bigger stone, we've dropped a block. Our water is about a 3.5 to a 4 pH depending on what water rainfall. And coming into the bed, and it's coming out of 7 out of the smaller stone, a 4.5 to a 5 out of the bigger stone. So
at our downstream monitoring site, and also a decrease in the amount of iron. So even though it still looks like there's a lot of iron in the creek, these projects have definitely made a measurable and visible difference.
We actually found mayfly just below the confluence last year. And I remember the first time I sampled it in 2009, there was nothing. Absolutely nothing.
There's only about 5 gallons per minute coming out of this bed. About 5 gallons.
A minute?
A minute, yeah. Altiers Oil Company owns this land. There's a good chance that this site never would have been reclaimed, or nothing would have come back. Because it had been like this for many, many years, and there really weren't any trees on this site. It's just pretty much a plain of gob.
Active oil well.
It's also part of West Branch Headwaters. Like I said, there was two different discharges that we wanted to treat. So while that one across the road is typically pH 3.5 to 4, high amount of aluminum, iron, the mine discharge that's coming from this side of the road, the mine discharge is actually coming right down the road. There's a culvert under the road where about half of it still goes directly into the creek. We have a sheet piling, things stuck down into the ground there so that the water level comes up, and we are actually getting the water to come into this pond, and then we are pumping it up there so that it has a little bit of aeration time, so it's hitting that mattress looking thing. It's basically called a fabriform channel, and it looked like a mattress pad pillow top cover that they pumped with concrete. So it is concrete, it's hard, with some gravity to fall down. Then with those dimples in the channel, we're really giving it a chance for the water to get agitated and for it to be aerated, for there to be a lot of oxygen going in there. We didn't have a lot of space at the site. Because of the road, because of the ODOT right-of-way, because of the hill, there's actually a deep mine that is right like right here at the edge. So we didn't want to go back any because we didn't want to get into the deep mine. We were really limited at this site on the amount of space we had for the wetland, but we still wanted it to settle out as much iron as possible. We hadn't ever used this on any of our projects, so it too was a little bit of an experiment. And we do feel like it's working really well because we are getting a lot of iron settling out very quickly. The water that's coming out over here couldn't be more different than the water that's over there, which just gives you a little bit of an idea of just how odd some of this mine chemistry is. Over there, pH of 4, aluminum iron. Over here, pH of 6, 6.5, and no aluminum at all. It's a high amount of iron. So totally different water, even though it's, you know, a couple football fields apart. That's just how mine chemistry is. So with that in mind, that's why it's so difficult to treat some of these sites, is because you can't just have a cookie cutter approach and be like, oh, we'll just throw a limestone leach bed in there, because you have to take into account specific site features, the specific chemistry of a site, any sort of limitations that you have to work around. For as small of a project as it was, we had a lot more trouble on this side of the road than we did over there. So once it did finally get online, you can see there was a bump in pH, even though it was started off pretty high. Same with acidity. We were at times measuring alkalinity coming off of this site. So even though it's water coming directly out of a mine, had a lot of metal in it, a lot of iron, there's still alkalinity in it. So it's not always acidic. The big difference in what shows success of this project is the amount of iron. So you can see that one is probably an outlier that was measured in 2004, but you can see it's pretty consistently high. And then once we constructed the wetland, it started dropping, and now we have a very low amount of iron that's coming out. And the outlet to this project, water's coming in on this corner, and it's exiting on the diagonal. The idea for both of these systems, because both the wetland and limestone leach bed are acting as settling ponds, we want the water to have as much retention time as possible. So like for this wetland, we estimate that the water is in here for about 6 to 8 hours. There are some big baffles that go all the way across. They've kind of gotten cooled down, and you can't get them to stay up as the wetland filled in. But the idea was to get the water to go all the way down horizontally, all the way back, and kind of snake back and forth through the wetland so that it would stay in longer. The drainage coming out used to be really, really low, and it was covered by a pipe almost the whole way. So nobody even knew it was there. And then all of a sudden, we tear up this area. We put this thing up there. We start pumping water out, and none of these cattails are here. So it's like straight view to that, that starts looking like it has all this red stuff on it. So I got so many calls about this project, and none of them were good. It was, what did you do out there? What are you doing on 155? Now that we have the wetlands, cattails have really come in. You can't really notice that as much because the cattails block it. We're getting a lot of birds here, a lot of frogs. It is serving as habitat, tons of frogs. The wetland will eventually fill up with iron. And actually, the next site that I'm going to take you to is a wetland that we just rehabbed. So you can imagine that probably the same thing will eventually have to happen at this site. One thing with this project is we're not capturing as much of the water. We knew we wouldn't be able to capture all of the flow that's coming out down by the road, but we aren't capturing as much as we expected. This is working max. This is as much water pretty much as we're able to get.
Compared to almost all of our other sites, is that power pole. Almost everywhere else we're working, we don't have access to electricity. So that's what made this a feasible option. And electric bill's really not that much when you look at the truth.
Water's pumped.
And that's the only input that's going into either one.
Come here to over there.
Enhancement project. This is our most recently completed project. It finished up this past fall. This is what it used to look like. You see a lot of the iron in that photo.
And that was the constructed wetland originally, correct?
Yeah, this is another view from the road of how it used to look. When we dug up all of this wetland, and then it looks like this right now, why I get phone calls and questions of, why did you mess up that pond? Is we're actually trying to enhance this wetland because, as Tim just said, this was a constructed wetland. DNR constructed this wetland in the late 80s. It was intended as an AMD treatment wetland, and it was actually built as a penalty project on an operating coal operator. So they had some sort of penalty. They had to, instead of just paying a fine, they said, well, you could do this project down, you know, in the watershed. So that's how this project was originally constructed. So this was not a natural wetland. It's always been an AMD treatment site. You know, this looks like a fairly nice wetland, right? But it's more like a pond. That's what everyone around here calls it, the pond. I said we were doing a project at the Drake's Wetland, and they're like, I don't know where that is. It's right on the road at the corner. Oh, you mean the big pond? Yep, the pond. So now I call it the Drake's Pond. In some places, this wetland ended up being about 6 feet deep. Once you get that deep, you're losing a lot of the benefit for the AMD treatment. You're not getting the types of reactions that you want. You're not necessarily getting the types of vegetation that you want. In addition to the deep spots, there still are three cells. The first cell was essentially a pond. The second cell, water was totally bypassing. And then the third cell was sort of functioning, but what we wanted to do was to try to bring this back to its functioning purpose, to get it to treat AMD. You can see a lot of the orange, before we did this project was concentrated right there along the road. So it's actually seeping out from the road cut. That's where most of the AMD is coming in. A good sign is that now it's orange throughout the pond, which means that the water is actually circulating through and using all of the pond, where before it was very isolated over in that corner, and then the water, you could tell, was just going straight over here to the outlet and going down into the next cells, so bypassing the second cell and then going in. So it wasn't getting the retention time that we really hoped for. So by adding these, the stone berms, those are made of limestone that not only slows the water down and kind of forces it to go a certain way, but it also adds some alkalinity. The iron falling out more quickly as the pH goes up. Adding that alkalinity was something that was never part of the original wetlands. That was an addition of the berms. We didn't extend the boundary of the wetland at all. It might have looked much smaller before because there was a lot of vegetation, a lot of cattails. Our plan is just to get some cattails from surrounding wetland areas and ponds and seed it ourselves. That's what we did for the wetland at the last site, and see, they've come in pretty well. So they don't need a lot of help, just with a more even depth and a lot more treatment potential with the alkalinity addition. You see frogs there all the time. You walk up on it and frogs jumping in like crazy. Even though we're not going to be able to get probably fish or a lot of really high quality bugs, it still has value for wildlife and for habitat. Big thing with this project was we wanted to catch the iron, because the pH was going to come up when it hits the stream anyways pretty quickly. Now that we have treatment upstream on the West Branch and the West Branch pH is consistently at 7 or right around 7, that wasn't as much the concern as just getting the iron out before it precipitated in the stream. There's water that comes in over there, there's water that comes in seeping through, but it goes down this corner and into the next cell, and then the outlet is to the left of the farm gate.
From 3.2 to 7,
so there was more material than they expected.
Cubic yards of iron precipitate
They actually
came off.
Brought in like a vacuum truck with a giant hose, and it was like a water tank truck with a big hose, and they sucked it out of the bottom. It looked.
Did they pump it to the creek?
They didn't. No. So,
how did you know? That's the side of the next one.
Yeah. Job security. No. Our initial idea was to try to bury it just over here on the other side of the creek, because same thing, if you bury it, cap it with clay, you can dispose of iron that way without having really any measurable impact on the surrounding areas. You have to let it dry. That's the big thing, is it takes a long time to dry because you're sucking all that material out, and then there's so much of it, but if you let it dry, then you can dispose dispose of it easier. But we ended up trucking it about a mile to another site where we were doing a little bit of maintenance on one of our previous projects, and we actually needed to fill in an area, so we used the material here, dried it, and then used it as fill, and then covered it, capped it with clay, and then reseeded it. Killing two birds with one stone, it was a safe, relatively near place to dispose of it.